It's all about the music. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Many of us have grown up in a post-polio world. By the early 1960s, inoculation against polio was routine and widespread. However, in the 1950s, when vaccine development was aggressively being pursued and tested, there were still many, many people afflicted. Paralytic polio spreads along nerve fibers, destroying motor neurons, most often resulting in some sort of paralysis. Carol Rosenberger has been on the classical music scene as a celebrated pianist, and then as a recording artist, and then as a driver behind the Delos classical recording label. Her identity as a musician has been part of a personal and artistic destiny that could not be thwarted by the debilitating effects of paralytic polio, which she contracted when she was emerging as an artist at the age of 21. She tells her story in To Play Again, a memoir of musical survival, which is an Independent Publishers Book Awards bronze medal winner and is a finalist for the Mae Sarton Women's Book Award. Carol's sheer tenacity at regaining her ability to play the piano inspires. Her musical instincts drove her to rebuild her skills as she gained acclaim for her interpretations. The story of her focused effort to redefine her own neuromuscular architecture so that she could play again is remarkable, and her natural way of talking about music opens up the mind and spirit of a gifted musician. I recently had the pleasure of sitting down with her. Let's listen to our conversation. Carol Rosenberger, welcome. It's so good to finally have you in the studio to talk about To Play Again, a memoir of musical survival.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you very much.
I have to start out by noting that the very title of your book is not just a memoir of survival, but it's a memoir of musical survival.
Yes, yes. That musical part is very important, obviously.
In the book, one of your teachers and mentors at one time when you were struggling to regain your music said he just wanted to see you happy. And you said you didn't care if you were happy. You wanted to be a pianist.
Right.
And that was your driver, your driver all the way through your journey. And I want to start your journey before you were afflicted with polio.
Okay. Yes, I had 21 years, and about 19 of them were with the piano, very important in my life.
You describe being even a toddler and reaching
way up high. I could hold myself up. I'm not sure if I could even walk, but at least I could get over to the piano and I could hold myself up with one hand and play notes with the other. And just, I thought that was the most heavenly thing one could possibly do. And I was, 18 months or something like that. And the piano was actually in my parents' home due to the fact that a friend of theirs had moved from a house to an apartment and didn't have room for his grand piano. And since my parents didn't have a whole lot of furniture as yet, they said, oh, sure, we'll house it for as long as you need for us to. And so when I came along, that was just the most glorious toy I could have imagined. And just stayed close. And of course, as we know, anything that becomes part of a person that early in life is there at a level that you really can't achieve later. It just happens that way. And when you start learning language and all those things. And so for me, music was there from the beginning, just my interaction with the instrument and with the sounds the instrument could make. And somehow I thought it was mine. And I learned to climb onto the bench and do my thing at the piano. And
you were impressing people from an early age, and that got you affiliated with teachers who found you had a remarkable ability of perfect pitch. And yes. And I found it interesting reading about this in your book, that the ability to recognize notes, I want to say almost independent of sound, that you seemed to have this ability to be able to intimately relate the notation on a page, the sound that is expected from that, and your ability to manifest that.
Yes, I suppose it could be described that way. To me, it always seemed each note, each tone, each sound had its own character to me, because I got to know them all so early in life. And I think that's another key to it. And I had favorites, and the way a piano is tuned may have had something to do with it, but they retain their character for me all through my life. You know, that the impression that they made on me so young, it was sort of an unbroken relationship with those sounds.
Throughout your life, and after you were afflicted with polio and had to relearn how to use your body to maintain that relationship with the instrument and the music. And what indeed marks your interpretation of music is that ability to have an emotional response that you are having and aiming to communicate to listeners.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, and all of the arduous reworking of reflexes after polio, something that everybody told me was impossible, had to do with always having the sound, the phrase, the chord, the musical section in my mind as an ideal, and then exploring, going on explorations neuromuscularly to try to figure out how I could get to that point musically. The old reflexes were gone. The ones that I had built until age 21 were gone. That's what all the medical people said would never come back. And so I might as well forget it and do something else. Well, that wasn't... that didn't seem the right way to me, but it took a lot of experimentation and agonizing kind of experimentation, I could add. But it was the musical idea, the ideal shape of a musical phrase, of the ideal resonance of a musical chord, et cetera, that had to be uppermost, that had to be in my imagination at all times. And then I just had to keep trying in what just seems, I can look back and say, oh, how did I stay at it so long, you know? But it did eventually work.
Well, this musical ideal is what you were working on and nurturing and growing when you were struck with polio as a young woman. You were studying in France and excited to be in Europe and in Paris and in with so many other creative people. And tell us a little bit about that, what in the book you call before polio,
BP.
Before polio.
Yes, BP. Well, I had gone to France to study with the legendary Nadia Boulanger, who was known as the musical personality, even for important composers to study with. And I mean, everybody just worshipped her. And when these summer sessions that a lot of Americans attended, mostly one encountered Mademoiselle in a group, you know, session of some sort. But she did give me a chance to play for her. And then once I had played for her, she wanted to hear me again. So I right away developed a special relationship with her musically, which was just thrilling to me. And then halfway through the summer, that's when the polio knocked me out. And she was of wonderful help. I so much wanted to stay in Europe and kind of keep learning whatever I could learn and absorbing whatever I could absorb while I was healing. Of course, I had no idea of the length of time it was going to take. And it was Mademoiselle who persuaded my parents to let me stay. And she was very caring and understanding. And I learned in the course of my sessions with her post-polio that her younger sister, Lily, had been very ill and had died way too young. And that I think that was one of the things that Mademoiselle felt immediately when I was stricken, that she would like to help me. That was a very important element in my starting out after the polio.
And you were stricken very badly.
Yes.
And yourself weren't sure what was going on or how severe this was going to impact you.
Yes, yes, and it was explained to me a few years later when I went to a polio specialist in Copenhagen that the polio virus, the second stage, the paralytic stage of the polio virus, kills those very motor neurons that have been most active in the period between the non-paralytic stage of the virus, which a lot of people have and don't even know they've had it, and the paralytic stage. And, of course, what was I doing in between those two? I was practicing the piano 8 hours a day. So what did the paralytic stage of the virus do? It knocked out everything that I most needed to play the piano.
And you were afflicted with polio at a time when the vaccine was just being discovered and administered to children.
Yes.
Because so many children had been affected by it over the previous 20, 30 years.
Yes.
And I guess your timing wasn't good on that.
No, I even tried to get the vaccine before I left the U.S. for Europe. But they said, well, it's just for children now. Come back in a few months. Well, guess what? I got mine the other way, the very bad way.
And something that strikes me throughout your book, and we'll talk about some of the other people in your life, but you had so many people around you from the very onset that were buoying you and serving as companions and helpers. And I don't know that maybe they didn't think you would emerge as a musician, or if they did think that, but people were very supportive of you and of your musical growth, even though you couldn't play.
Yes, yes, that's right. Well, Mademoiselle was first among them in a way. And of course, some of my friends from the summer sessions at Fontainebleau, just none of us knew how long this was going to take. They probably thought, you know, I'd be getting better and then we'd get back to our chamber music and our piano and voice things that we were doing and, you know, all the interesting musical activities that we were doing together. And I think nobody realized how long this was going to take. And even then, when I left Paris to go to Vienna, because it was going to be much less expensive to live in Vienna, and I did not want to go home from Europe, somehow I thought, well, I can be learning things here. I can be improving my French, and then I can be learning German, and I can be going to all the wonderful concerts that there are here and studying harpsichord or studying Baroque style. I couldn't really play yet, but all those kinds of things that I did in the years right after the paralytic attack were all focused on improving my overall musicianship. It wasn't just, okay, I'll do this until. It was well, this will help with my understanding of song. This will help. I just had all these rationalizations why I should continue. And I think I was not too far off, actually.
Well, in your talking about it in the book, I think for many readers, they'll find that it's an incredible story you have of this personal triumph. But I felt it also opened up music for me to hear you as a musician, as a pianist, talk about how you would even analyze music, and then how this knowledge that you were gaining while you were unable even maybe to wear a coat without being in pain, you were in constant pain, but this way of looking at music to me made me see concert musicians differently, that it's not merely practicing, but it's a much more integrated and complex process to really fulfill that destiny of being a concert musician.
Yes, and to do absolutely the highest level recreation one possibly can of these masterpieces that one is drawn to. And that's you can call it a sacred duty of some kind or whatever, but I certainly saw it that way, any way I could understand a little more about Mr. Beethoven or any way I could understand a little more about how song influences this particular piece of music or this particular phrase, all those things I just knew would improve what I could do in recreating this music.
And I want to take a little left turn here and have you describe for me, because I'm curious about it, the Schenker theory? Yes, what that is and how you applied it.
Well, it was fascinating. I had never heard of it before I was in Vienna, and one day I walked past a classroom where something was going on that looked kind of interesting, because the professor was analyzing a Beethoven sonata in a different way. And so I sat in the back row and just, you know, as an observer, which one could do if one was enrolled in the academy. And he was drawing graphs of musical events in the sonata. And the way he drew those graphs, I thought, oh, this shows what Beethoven's underlying structure is of this sonata. This is marvelous, because ordinary musical analysis tends to be sort of chord by chord or something like that, and you don't see the overall architecture. Whereas Heinrich Schenker's theory and his graphs that he came up with showed, let's say, an entire Beethoven movement as one big graph, and you could see the most important lines, and then you could see the sub lines and how they all kind of interacted, and you could see the overarching harmonic idea and then all the things that the sub ideas that added to it. And it just hit home to me. I thought, that's the way I've always felt about especially these wonderful structured musical masterpieces. And here's somebody who's drawing a graph of it? I never saw anything like that before. And I was absolutely fascinated, and so I kept auditing the class, which you could do if you were enrolled in the academy. And pretty soon I was going to all three. The Professor Eibner had three sort of levels of the course. And I found myself going to each one. finally he... Seeing that this person was, you know, sitting in the back and just observing all three levels of his class, he finally beckoned to me one day and started asking me, you know, what my major was and asking me about my interest in Schenker. And I didn't want to tell him about my illness. I tried very hard to kind of keep that out of conversations because I thought people would just disregard me if they knew that I wasn't a whole person, you know. But he was just interested in the fact that I was so struck by Schenker theory, and so he offered. He said, "What was I studying at the moment, and would I like a private lesson about whatever music I was working on at the time?" And of course, I didn't tell him I couldn't play much of anything. I said, "Oh yes, I would very much like, you know." And so I brought him in some pieces I was particularly wanting to think my way through, so that someday I could play them, you know. So we had a wonderful series of lessons and sessions, and he seemed to be enjoying our joint analysis together a lot. And one day, after this had been going on for a while, he said to me, "I'd like to know how this is helping your piano playing. What effect is this having?" And I thought, oh, well, here we go. This is probably the last session we'll have when I tell him that I really can't play at this point. And so I told him my story and said, of course, I still was acting as if I were going to be back and much sooner than I really could come back. And he turned around. And tears were rolling down his face as I told him what had happened to me. And then he started telling me about some god-awful things that had happened to him and his close family and friends during the war. And we must have talked for an hour and a half, with him doing a lot of weeping. I was too, of course.
You were bound together by loss and by pain.
By pain, yes. Exactly, yes. Exactly. And so our relationship just kind of grew from there. And one of the most wonderful things I remember when I finally did make it back many years later to actually playing the piano again and performing again, my first tour took me to Vienna my first European tour. And Professor Eibner was there. And we hardly even had to say very much. He was so thrilled that I was playing again and that he had seen it, you know, kind of all that way through. That was a wonderful experience.
I am talking with Carol Rosenberger. She tells her extraordinary experience of loss and life and music in To Play Again, a memoir of musical survival. Let's take a short break and listen to Barcarolle, a Richard Rodney Bennett composition played on the Bösendorfer Imperial Concert Grand Piano by my guest, Carol Rosenberger. The Bösendorfer, Carol calls hers Bosey, is a completely handmade instrument built in Vienna and acknowledged as the finest piano made. Only a few hundred a year are even manufactured, and the concert grands, like Carol's Bosey, are unique in their resonance and purity of tone. Carol Rosenberger from the Delos release of the album The Bösendorfer Sound. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is a novel idea. Carol's upper body was afflicted with neuromuscular damage due to polio, which she contracted when she was 21 and living abroad. Despite her illness and need for recovery and rehabilitation, she stayed in Europe and continued her musical studies. Initially, in the immediate wake of her contracting polio, she could not play at all.
You couldn't really play, and your descriptions of it in the book, I almost could visualize you awkwardly trying to even just make a small phrase or
yes.
sound, and yet you seemed not to get discouraged. I'm sure you did, but you persevered. But it took you many years to
yes.
learn how to use your own body
yes.
and how to understand really what happened to your body and maybe some of your initial compensation that allowed you to play, you then got better information and were
continually revising
yes.
how you played the piano, which
yes.
maybe most musicians don't experience in their lives.
Well, I hope they don't have to. But yes, it was, well, it was my only path because I had some compensatory movements that didn't work very well. One really key few months in this long process I spent up in Copenhagen, as I mentioned, and they helped a lot. Also helped me to understand. And at the end of my time with them, the doctor in charge still said, look, whatever hasn't come back in another year won't come back at all. And I thought, oh, but I've just begun. And so I kept giving myself another year and then another year and then another year. And I actually made a very important step. I'm moving considerably ahead here, but when a psychologist friend of mine, once I'd gotten back to the U.S., who loved classical music and who somehow knew that what I really needed to do was to have two or three people, four or five people come in and say, oh, could we hear you play this or that, or could you play such and such for us? And that would somehow enable me to find more than I'd found thus far neuromuscularly. I was having to find new pathways. And through her insight and inviting a few of her friends over and so that I could play something for them, I found that the very act of playing for people who said it meant a lot to them to hear that piece of music and the adrenaline, I mean, it was terrifying to play for even one person. But what the adrenalized state does for you is it seems to slow everything down. Now, normal pianists find that they, you know, that's a little scary, but they rely on reflex. For me, the reflexes weren't built in at all, but I kept searching for better connections and better simulations of the reflexes. And that time slowdown actually helped me, of the adrenalized state, playing for just these few people, actually helped me to find things I never would have found otherwise. So this psychologist friend of mine did me just the most wonderful favor one could possibly imagine by saying, oh, it'll mean so much to so-and-so and so-and-so if you could just play a little for them.
In the book, you do talk a lot about your working through playing for others. And in fact, did you call it a playthrough?
Yes.
And like a little mini concert in someone's living room.
Yes.
But it also seemed like you were re-engaging that maybe was your underlying ability before you had polio to have this relationship with the music and with the audience.
Yes.
And that it was this synergy.
Yes.
And I also found it fascinating just that you were engaging with parts of your hands, arms, back, wrists, re-engaging or recruiting mm-hmm. different parts of your anatomy to regain that ability to have that synergistic relationship.
Yes, and I could practice with all that in mind, but it's heightened when there are even a couple people in the room, one or two, you know, because then you're wanting to present something to them, so that there's another factor. And as I say, it always produced a heightened adrenalized state when I did that, even for one or two people. So that gave me a sense of more time to find the right path, neuromuscular pathway. And at the same time, of course, I always kept in mind that divine music that I wanted to communicate to them. And it was a lot a lot of playthroughs, thanks to this friend of mine who kept setting them up for me.
And which friend is that?
Her name was Amelia Haygood, and she was a psychologist.
And record producer.
She was a great music lover, and she was, at the time I met her, she was working with kids who had gone astray, kids in Watts who had gone astray, and their families, trying to get them back home. That's the kind of person she was. And at one point in her career as a psychologist, she had shown other people how to do that, what she'd been doing in Watts, and she decided to follow her love of great music and combine that with the fact that she had met a number of American performing artists who didn't have any recordings. And she realized, she and her husband, who had died by that time, but she and her husband had been tremendous record collectors. And they both loved classical music and had just all these, LPs and so on. And she realized that all of her treasured recordings were European artists, and yet she had met American artists who should be recorded. So she went from one mission to another mission, and her next mission was to start a recording company. And everybody told her she was crazy and she'd lose her shirt and all that kind of stuff. But some of her close friends that she had worked with for many years, social workers, probation officers, psychologists, all thought this was really exciting. And so they wanted to jump in and help as volunteers any way they could. And so that's how Delos was born.
Which I thought in your memoir, and I'm talking with Carol Rosenberger, and the book is To Play Again, a memoir of musical survival. And you have these, it's not only a story of your coming back from this paralytic polio and becoming a successful concert pianist and a respected concert pianist. But it's also an incredible story of friendship and friendships that you have had, long-lasting friendships.
Yes.
And that was rather remarkable, too.
Indeed. Oh, yes. Yes, I've been very, very fortunate in my close friends throughout my life, really. And Amelia was exceptional. There were a number of others who were really, at various times in my life, just made a huge difference, made it possible for me to get through that phase. Definitely, no question. Yes, I just, and of course, when Amelia founded Delos and then there was a tremendous amount to be done, I jumped in and tried to help when I wasn't on tour and all that kind of thing. And then when she died in 2007, and our chief engineer died just a few weeks after she did, I realized that I had to jump in and see if I could keep Delos label going, because who else was going to do it, you know? So, yes, and I've had very good friends who've helped me with that, too.
You've had a very busy life once you came back to the States and migrated westward.
Yes.
And were living in L.A. and teaching a lot. And
yeah,
then you were touring a lot.
Yes.
And it seems like you have been very driven and continually working on improving and
maintaining
yeah, what you do physically.
Yes, that is an absolute necessity. And every medical person I worked with cautioned me way from way back when. You know, everyone cautioned me that I was going to have to be careful, that I was going to have to spend a certain amount of time each day doing my stretches and my this and my that, you know, post-polio things to try to keep the post-polio effects down as much as possible. Yeah.
And Carol, at first you, as you said, you weren't really wanting to share with people that, especially when you came back to playing. And maybe some people didn't realize that you had polio, and you didn't want
people to know, but there were a few people who said, no, you have to tell your story.
Well, I didn't tell anybody. That first European tour that I mentioned, I didn't tell anyone. I was invited to do the tour, and I thought, not one word about polio. I don't want it to get out, because I don't want anybody looking at me and saying, oh, yeah, I see, you know. She's doing this rather than that. I just didn't want any kind of bias at all, you know. And so I didn't tell the people who arranged the tour. And then when I got back, and the person who wanted to be my American tour manager, artist manager, I thought, oh, my gosh, and I never told him. I mean, he was in New York and I was in California, and I thought, I had never told him about the polio. Now I'm going to have to tell him, because I might have to take some time off to do some special treatment or something, and it's not fair to him if I don't tell him. So I went to New York, and we had a nice dinner, and then after dinner I said, Sir Sherman, there's something I need to tell you. And I thought, here goes. And so I told him. I said, you know, if you want to out of the contract, that's okay. I'll understand, because I may not be, you know, your most reliable artist. And he just said, oh, what an amazing story. This should not be kept secret. I can't wait to tell so-and-so about it. And from that time on, it was out.
And was that a relief to you? Was that freeing at all? Or did it recontextualize things for you?
It was a little scary. I thought, oh, what if people now see some things that I might be doing differently than somebody else? Nobody ever said anything like that. And as I got through the next year and a half, 2 years of touring, and nobody said anything except, oh, my God, how did she manage to do that? You know, maybe when they found out about the story. And there were no negatives. And so I thought, okay, all right, now I'm comfortable.
I mean, in fact, quite the contrary.
You
were, you know, you got amazing reviews and
yes.
For your interpretation
of
music.
Yes, for my musicianship. And I thought, well, this is much more than I ever dreamed of.
Yeah. Well, there's so much more in the book that we can talk about and in your life that we could talk about. But I wanted to ask you, because in the latter half of the book, you do talk about the recording company, about Delos,
yes.
and about you were recording. And I wondered what are some of the differences, because you talked about having, I don't remember if you said it was a fear, but nervousness around the mic.
Yes.
And so what is the difference between playing in front of a live audience or recording in a hall versus recording in a studio, that sort of thing?
Well, if you're playing for a live audience, it's the communication between you and the audience. That's the thing. Forget everything else. That's the thing. You don't even think about microphones somewhere. It's between you and the audience. And that always meant a lot to me. So I was not uncomfortable when I found out that they were going to record a live performance. That didn't make me nervous or anything, because I was focused on whatever was going to happen during that time between me and the audience. But going into a recording studio was scary, because I just thought of a microphone focused on my hands, kind of, and I thought, oh, maybe the microphone will pick up something that I don't know. It was just... It was maybe a little bit irrational, because by then I'd been well accepted in the concert world, but it was scary at first. And then when the first couple of recordings went well, and even I, when I listened to playback, couldn't really hear, you know, any problem in particular, except that one is always critical of one's own work, but then, you know, that's a given. So then I got more relaxed about it.
And throughout the book, you talk about Beethoven's Opus 111. And
yes.
I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, because it seemed that had, throughout your life, some significance.
Yes. And at the time of the polio attack, right after the polio attack. One of the things that I talked about with Mademoiselle Boulanger was that I was going to do some mental practice. I couldn't do anything at the piano, of course, but I could do mental practice, mental study of whatever music meant the most to me, whatever piano music meant the most. Well, the most monumental was Opus 111 in my mind. And so at that time, during those months that I had sessions with Mademoiselle, we talked about late Beethoven. Actually, we went through all three of the late Beethoven sonatas, 109, 110, and 111. And then one of the first, or at least one of the first pieces that I went through the whole Schenker process with Professor Eibner was the Opus 111. And it was kind of like a holy grail to me. So I figured out a way to play even the most treacherous passages in it. And its overall message was on such a high level and so enveloping that the music itself reassured me that I could do it somehow. I don't know how better to explain it than that. I did play the Opus 111 early on in my touring life and at a number of really important performance occasions, and then I did record it also. Yeah, that was a high point.
Carol Rosenberger, I want to encourage our listeners today to pick up your book, To Play Again, a memoir, and to listen to your music while they're reading the book. It is a story not only of hope and your own personal transformation, but I think it's insightful into the mind and practice of a musician, and that is what is special about the book. It opens up that experience for me as a listener.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. Oh, that's yes. So nice to hear.
I just want to say, is there anything else that you want to add or want to talk about or want to cover?
I guess just that my devotion is now to Delos. And I'm not performing anymore, and the only recording I do is occasional for a piece of new music where I can kind of jump in and be part of a recording. But my focus really is on keeping Delos's heritage intact and also in continuing to add really interesting projects to our catalog.
So you're working hard still.
Yeah, and surprise, surprise.
And do you play every day?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Your Bosey, is that what is the, I forget the.
Yeah, it's a Bösendorfer Concert Grand, Imperial Grand piano. And it's one that is built to sing. They were made in Austria. I discovered them when I was in Austria, actually. And so I've made a number of recordings on this wonderful Bösendorfer that I ended up buying so that I could make sure it was always in my life. And yes, I do go to Bosey, as I call it, just about every day. And Bosey and I sort of sing together, make music together. And
I found it interesting that throughout the book also you talk about your pianos and having two grand pianos in one room and then another one in another room and the moving your piano to a concert space, which I would think would be like terrifying.
Frightening. Yes, it is. It is. You have to really trust the mover.
And then kind of let it sit for a while and get used to its new space.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, yes. I was always doing it a favor when I would let it do that.
Uh-huh. Thanks for coming in today, Carol.
Thank you. My very great pleasure.
I have been speaking with Carol Rosenberger, and her book is To Play Again, a memoir of musical survival, just nominated for a May Sarton Women's Book Award. Let's listen to more of Carol playing, and this from her Delos recording, Water Music of the Impressionists, a Critics' Choice winner from Gramophone, one of Billboard magazine's all-time great recordings, and Stereo Review's Best Classical Compact Disc. Carol Rosenberger on her Bösendorfer Imperial Concert Grand Piano,
brings us Debussy's Jardin sous la pluie. Carol Rosenberger from her album Water Music of the Impressionists. Her memoir is To Play Again, and in our conversation, Carol mentioned Delos Music, a label hosting many of the most honored performers of classical music. In a time when venues for classical music are diminishing, Delos, named after the Greek island, said to be the birthplace of Apollo, remains a platform for many contemporary performers of classical music. So I'd also like to share composer Mark Abel's world premiere recording, the Delos release of his album, Time and Distance, and this is The Invocation, with lyrics by the composer, featuring mezzo-soprano Janelle DiStefano and Carol Rosenberger on the piano. Thank you. The Invocation, Mark Abel's world premiere recording, Time and Distance. We opened the show with three tone pictures by Charles Tomlinson Griffiths from Carol's Delos album, Reveries. I thank my guest, Carol Rosenberger. Her memoir is To Play Again, and I thank composer Mark Abel. Thank you for listening. You can listen to all our podcasts and subscribe as well at norcalpublicmedia.org. I've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. This is a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Northern California Public Media. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea.